Calcio Land Podcast with David Amoyal.
Benvenuti, as we would say in Italy. Welcome to all of you that don't speak Italian. Thank you so much for joining us for the Friday episode of the Calcio Land Podcast. And we have a really good one today. I know I've been saying that often, but I've been really trying to challenge myself to make these episodes recently extra special. So we do have today two fantastic guests, the staple of the show, I would say a backbone of the show, our dear friend Napoli Outsider. On this version of the pod, you'll hear him talk just about Napoli, him and I. And we have a great first-time guest. And I know the listeners that we do have in Italy are going to be very impressed with the fact we have Giuseppe Pastore on the podcast. He is the master of the stats and the facts for Calcio. He's a huge movie buff like me, and he has a book on the greatest Italian soccer team I ever saw, Sacchi's Milan, but he covers through the few years after that, a fantastic book that came out in Italy actually yesterday. So today we have really a fantastic show. At the end, we're going to wrap it up talking a little bit about Tool and the 50-year anniversary of Godfather. But before we get to all that, I'm joined by our dear friend, producer, co-host of the show, Alex Goldberg. So our patrons know that on Tuesday, we had Alex on that show, which, you know, happens once in a while. And, you know, I had asked Alex that if Ronaldo were to leave Man United this summer after just one season, what would that say more? Would it say more about Ronaldo or Man United? But I want to flip it today and pretty much ask the same question about Lukaku, because there continues to be buzz on Lukaku wanting a return to Inter. So, Alex, I have to ask you this. Let's say in the summer they figure out a way to send Lukaku back to Inter. I'm not a reporter. I don't know if that's going to happen or not. But let's say hypothetically that happens. Would that say more about Lukaku or Chelsea's decision to bring him back? Because I'll tell you, the thing that blows me the way more out of the whole Lukaku situation, and both you and I thought it was a home run for Chelsea, is the fact that they knew each other. He had already been there. So to me, that really blows me away. So let's say they find a way to divorce this summer. Does it say more about Lukaku's inability to succeed there, Chelsea's decision to bring him back?
Oh, this one's such a good question, because this one's even closer. And I liked the Ronaldo question for sure, but this one's even closer because it's not a good look on either, is it, David? It really, really isn't. Lukaku, I don't know how much it stains his legacy, his reputation, but it's not good. It's not good. Like, if things don't get better between now and the end of the season, if Lukaku doesn't finish as Chelsea's top scorer in the Premier League, if that goes to a Mount or Jorginho or Ziyech, and it's not going to be that much more than 9, 10, 11 goals, whoever's leading, unless, once again, Lukaku just completely picks it up and goes on a rampage. Right now he has 5 Premier League goals. If he doesn't really improve things between now and the end of the season, that's bad from Lukaku. Bad. Because you know what, David? It continues to run the narrative that he's not suited to be in a top Premier League team. Now, a top team in general, some are saying, but that's a complete disservice to Inter last season within the league, and it still becomes a different conversation. A top team, like a team to win Serie A, is that still a team that's a top team around Europe? And I'm not at all trying to slander Serie A, but David, you'll be the first one to admit, teams from Serie A have trouble in Europe. In fact, Atalanta might be the one that is like the most fearless in Europe these days. So it still kind of is different. So if Lukaku does not turn things around between now and the end of the season, and this is it for him in a Chelsea shirt, it continues to run the narrative that he is made for an Everton or a West Brom if he's going to play for a top team in the Premier League. And why is that? Well, top teams in the Premier League have a lot of possession, which means a lot of teams park the bus against them. And we know, if you just didn't even watch Lukaku at Inter last season, and you just want to go on YouTube and watch all of his goals, a compilation of all of Lukaku's goals from last season, pens, tap-ins, and counters. The counters are beautiful, but pens, tap-ins, and counters. That's the majority of the goals. That doesn't really transition well to a top Premier League side who is heavily possession-based. So that would not be the greatest look on Lukaku, David, because already at this point, and I was wrong. Listen, I've taken the L so many times recently. but it's been so clear to me. I've said this so much lately. My goodness, did I make a mistake putting this guy even close to the tier of a Benzema, of a Lewandowski, or a Kane. They are strikers. They might have their preferred formations and setups and styles, but they are strikers based on the way that they play. They can play in a variety of different setups. Unfortunately, I now view Lukaku differently. I view him as a very good goal scorer, but not an elite striker. Not at all. So his reputation has a lot at stake here because the number one thing he'll have in his corner when he retires, of course, individual moments, what he did for Inter is huge. I'm not going to take that away from any Inter fan. That's massive. Ending Juve's Scudetto reign, Lukaku was amazing. But at the end of his career, I think his biggest accomplishment could be just the goals that he scored. And I'm not going to poo-poo that either. He scores wherever he goes, except for at Chelsea right now. So, listen, he's still better than so many players. But the way he wants to be thought of, that's my big thing. The way he wants to be thought of, he is drastically failing that. Drastically. So it's not a good look on Lukaku. But, David, I'm going to go with it's a worse look on Chelsea. It's a worse look on Chelsea. You spent £100 million. And once again, people listening, I am yelling at Chelsea here. But don't worry, I'm not being a hypocrite. I am also kind of yelling at myself, all right? I've taken the L so many times. But Chelsea, you spent £100 million on a player that it's so obvious doesn't fit in the system. It's just so obvious. And everyone gets the L. Everyone. Marina, you get the L. Because at this point, you won't pay for players that probably do fit the system. And then because it's just kind of common thought that a player should come to the club, system or not, you pay an extraordinary amount of money for someone who clearly does not fit the system. Fine, but you're not the football person, right? All right, Petter, was that out of sentiment? Because you do kind of have a little bit of a driving role behind transfers. Did you get it wrong? You've played the game for a long, long time. You know Lukaku. You know how Tuchel likes to play. Probably better than Marina. So you definitely deserve some blame. Roman, you whipped out the checkbook. You did. Now, you're not really the football person, but how many people actually reported to you on true scouting analysis with Lukaku and how he would fit? Because you need those people to report to you, right? Well, Chelsea's scouting department sucks anyway in comparison to a Liverpool and a City. Absolutely is woeful. Hence, Drinkwater, Saul, Bakayoko. I could go on and on and on. Club targets, doesn't matter the manager who's in charge. They just buy the club targets. Really piss poor. And Tuchel. I come down to Tuchel here a little bit. It's a little gray, David, because Tuchel, it was his first summer. He knows his reputation a little bit like Conte. Conte's is off the fucking face of the earth, pardon my French. And who knows, that was pretty intense. I'll probably have to bleep out that effort. But Conte's reputation is just through the roof in terms of hostility with any club he's at over transfers. Tuchel had a little bit of that reputation, and he was super mindful going into this past summer about that. He had just won the Champions League. He kind of knew already they were going to back him to some extent. Everyone thought, we need a goal scorer. So Tuchel really said, yeah, I'll take a Lukaku. It really wasn't Tuchel's specific target, but above all, he was happy getting a guy with a proven goal-scoring record and a front man, a target man, a focal point, like Tuchel put it. So he deserves a little bit of blame. He gets a little bit of blame just because maybe he could have spoke up a little bit more without creating that tension because he knows his system better than anyone. And at this point, it's clear he's not throwing out his system for one guy. The other night, Kai Havertz steps in the exact same role, okay? It is comparable because not only was the opponent in this game, okay, Lille, playing the exact same formation that Palace played the other day, it was the same formation, same style for Chelsea. Everything was basically the same. And in 7 minutes, Kai Havertz did more than Lukaku did in 90+. Horrible look on Lukaku. Like, absolutely catastrophic. But also, it just proves Tuchel is keeping this for right now. He's keeping this style. And it's so clear that he's not going to change everything for Lukaku. And he clearly has done the risk-reward, David, and has decided, well, it's not actually worth it. If we cater to Lukaku, is it worth it for the team? So, Chelsea, where was the scouting? I go back to what I said earlier in this answer. If you looked at him at Inter, all the goals he scored, did that really project into the team? I should have realized that. That's a huge miss on my part. But £100 million, you got that so badly wrong. It just makes me think they went in with a blindfold and said, we just need someone who scored goals. We don't care the style of player he is. So, David, it's a bad look on Lukaku. It is. But it's even worse on Chelsea because I know they have spent a lot of money lately. But £100 million, that's a whole different thing. And they got it so badly wrong. So, yeah, David, what do you make of the whole situation?
Well, great answer. And I'm going to go in a second in a very different philosophical tangent. But a couple of things that you said stood out to me. Like once you were talking, for some reason, I went back to when Juve sold Pogba back to Man United for the record-breaking fee at the time. And obviously, it's a little bit different because Inter hadn't bought Lukaku from Chelsea directly, but Chelsea had Lukaku, so they knew what the player was. And obviously, Pogba's profile had risen a ton at Juve by the time he went back to Man United, but it's a little bit different. But it was the same guy who sold the player for a record-breaking fee, and that's Marotta. And I think both times he really looks like a genius. But I'll tell you, this whole Lukaku thing makes me realize like how much the world has changed. And I've been reading this book by Chuck Klosterman on the 90s, and Chuck Klosterman is one of my favorite writers. He does sports a little bit. He was on Grantland. You hear him on The Ringer, but he's really more about pop culture. And the book's about the 90s, and it's really a lot about how much the world has changed. And one of the riffs that he has on there, and it's something that I heard him say on a podcast a few months ago, and it really, really stayed with me. And he goes, you know, older generations look to younger people and complain. They think they're softer. They have it easier. They're not as tough. And Klosterman said, why would we expect that to be any different? He goes, I grew up in air conditioning. I grew up in totally different conditions than my grandparents. So of course, I'm going to be softer and in a different way. But that is progress in life. So I think so much about that riff. It really made me change how I look at a lot of situations. And the Lukaku situation, it makes me think of like the changes in power in a player empowerment. We've been talking a lot about this on the podcast for a while, how the Bosman's changing and it's becoming a lot more like the NBA. NBA free agency where, you know, the top stars pick up and leave and go. And we are seeing in the NBA, it's really to the extreme. Now, superstars change teams all the times, and superstars are just like, okay, I'm not in an ideal situation here. I'm not going to put in all the work to try to make it better. Let me just try to go somewhere else where it's going to be better. And let me try to team up with other people. Now, if you're old school, you're going to be like, huh, man, these guys are softer. Jordan was just like, oh, let me win on the Bulls. But situations change. And maybe the fact that teams had so much power in the past wasn't such a great thing. So how do I tie this back to Lukaku? Here's a guy that, you know, was at Inter, kept saying how much he loved it there. And that was definitely the time in his career where he was most beloved. And I think what we've learned about Lukaku is that he really does seek that approval. I know, Alex, you talk a lot about him, you know, trying to portray this alpha male thing, but deep down he's really not. And I totally agree with you. He strikes me as someone that just really desperately wants people's approval. And he had that at Inter. And we've talked in the past how sometimes in life growth can be deceiving, that you think, oh, I'm going to go to a better team. I'm going to make more money. I'm going to go to a team that I know because I've been there before. On the surface, all this made sense, but it didn't work out. Now he goes to Chelsea, and I think you made a great point that it is a bad look for Chelsea, because why would Chelsea have to radically change their system with Tuchel? It worked so well that they won the Champions League. And I thought, you know, before they went on this, they nosedive that they had a few months ago, I thought they were going to win it again. So, of course, you're like, why would you change something that worked so well? So now instead of trying to work it out, Lukaku is like, you know what? He's playing like someone that's almost giving up. Like, yeah. You've talked a lot about his body language. So I really think about that. But I go back to that Klosterman riff that now he's like, you know, I have player empowerment. I can get back to Inter. He had the opportunity to give an interview to Sky Sport, huge platform in Italy, as big as it gets. Not a lot of players in the past had the luxury to do something like this. Like, players now have a lot more that they can do to control the future. By the same token, we have clubs like Chelsea that can't afford these huge mistakes. Like, look at Man United. It didn't work out great with Pogba. Did that stop him from spending? No. Chelsea, they're going to be able to make up for this mistake. So they have the financial wherewithal to be able to bounce back from this. So no big deal for them. Lukaku, listen, if I had to guess, seeing how things are going, and I'm not a reporter, this is just a guess for where I'm sitting. If you told me, is it more likely than not that Lukaku a year from now, so within two transfer windows, is back at Inter? I would say it's pretty likely. And we've talked on the pod, you know, Dzeko's getting older. People are like, oh, you know, can we upgrade from Lautaro? And look, you know, if Inter went to a one-striker system and was like, okay, we'll sacrifice Lautaro, will bring back Lukaku on a cheap, it works out. So I keep thinking of that close-to-min rift that now younger people are softer, and I don't see it as a negative. They just have more options, and it's just something we're going to have to get used to with Lukaku. But I think you said a lot of great things there. Like you, Alex, I was 100% certain he was going to be fantastic there, and it didn't work out. And that's the other thing in life that I'm learning. You know, there's been so many times that I've been so certain. I thought Kulusevski at Juve was going to be a massive, massive hit, and it just wasn't. So I find this whole Lukaku thing truly fascinating. So today, guys, we do have a long show. We got a lot of stuff. We had a strong opening statement. We have 1,000 names in a second. We have 2 interviews, so pace yourself. We have timestamps. If you want to do the whole episode, great. You know, a lot of podcasts that I listen to are long, and I like to do a podcast that I would like. So I break it up sometimes. So I hope you do enjoy the content today, because we really do have some great stuff. So let's get the 1,000 names. So there are actually 2 Serie A games today. Only one of them is in our game picks, so you can kind of see how 1,000 does. Milan is also playing today against Udinese. So the games we're going to cover today: Empoli hosting Juventus. If you remember, the first time these teams faced this season, Empoli won in Turin. 1,000 has it 1-1, goals by De Ligt and Pinamonti. He says Andrea Zolin, that's Empoli's manager, with his Tuscan tiki-taka gives nightmares to Allegri. He says Empoli left-back Parisi is going to humiliate Cuadrado, and that Szczesny is going to make a terrible mistake in this match. In Italian, Empoli-Juve 1-1, De Ligt, Pinamonti, Andrea Zolin col suo tiki-taka toscano fa venire gli incubi di Allegri. Cuadrado umiliato da Parigi, Szczesny paperissima. So Empoli, one of the surprise teams, maybe not as strong as a stretch they had in the fall, early winter. Juve still trying to get back in the top 4. I don't think they are in the Scudetto race. Not a great Champions League result, but I'm going to go Juve 1-0, and I'm going to ride the Vlahovic train. And man, I'm sure Chelsea would love to flip Vlahovic for Lukaku right now. Next up, Inter goes to Genoa to face Genoa. And 1,000 has him winning 2-0. Goals by Calhanoglu and Dumfries. He says both Lautaro and Perisic are going to miss a penalty. De Vrij is going to get a red card. And he says Simone Inzaghi returns to win and is going to make Klopp shake. He says Inter strikers can't score even if they use their hands, and that Ballardini is returning to Genoa. I have to say, I do like the way Genoa play under this new manager, but I think they are preparing more for life in Serie B next season. You guys know I'm pretty bullish on Inter. I do think they come back to winning here, and I think Lautaro gets out of his slump. So I'm going to go Inter 1-0. I got some low scoring games. I guess I'm not really in line with how steady I is doing this season, so we're gonna try to do better on the last one. Roma traveling to Spezia. So 1,000 has Roma winning 2-0, goals by Pellegrini and your boy Tammy Abraham. Mourinho is going to explain life to his disciple Thiago Motta. Mourinho is playing one of his players from the treble. But he does one too many substitution, and Spezia is going to win 3-0 in a ruling after the match. Okay, I'm not going to do the extra sub. Man, Roma's been all over the place. Great comeback with young players, man. Who would have thought Mourinho falls 2-0 at home and gets bailed out by 2 young players off the bench? Spezia been a little bit all over the place. I'm going to go 2-2. There's going to be I need some high scores goals on Spezia. I'll give two goals to Manaj, but for my boy Jimmy Fontana, who's his agent, and on Roma, I'll give two goals to Tammy. So great stuff. Thank you, Thousand Names. Okay, so let's get to our first guest, the staple, one of the backbones of the show with Alex Goldberg, my dear friend Napoli Outsider. So on this part of the pod, you'll hear him talk about Napoli. Our patrons are also going to get a special version of the pod just with him talking about the rest of Serie A. Oh, I was just chatting with my dear friend Napoli Outsider, and I was telling him how, you know, like TV shows or podcasts, right when it's like ratings week and they're trying to get a rating bounce, they bring in really, really awesome guests. So today we have him on the regular podcast and we have Giuseppe Pastore at the end. So I'm really, really psyched for this episode. So what we'll do today, Napoli Outsider and I are going to chat about Napoli season on this part of the podcast, free to all. And then we'll keep going talking about other storylines in Serie A, and those will be for our patrons. So my dear friend, it's always a real pleasure to chat calcio with you. Bentornato to Calcio Land.
Thanks, David, and flattered to be on such a good show tonight.
Yeah, no, it'll be really good. So let's start here. I texted you right after the Napoli-Inter game saying that I thought that was really a big wasted opportunity for the team. And then they followed that up with, you know, what was one of the most boring games I've seen in Serie A this season against Cagliari, where Osimhen bails him out at the end. So between those two matches, which felt like more of a wasted opportunity to you?
Well, I know a lot of people are going to answer the Cagliari game, but for me, it's quite the opposite. I was actually quite happy with the draw. I thought, the situations were completely different. Napoli faced Inter, and they had a lot of players available, and Inter were at their lowest, and the Napoli absolutely dominated the first half. Then Inter got almost of a casual goal after a couple of rebounds at the beginning of the second half, and Napoli just got scared. They took a step back, and they allowed Inter to keep the game there in check, holding possession from then on. And Inter had the territorial advantage. Now, what was interesting is that Inter were actually so out of form that even though Napoli basically gave the ball up to them and retreated close to their penalty box, Inter did not have any chance to win the game after that 1-1. And that just tells you how if Napoli just dared a bit or had a bit of bravery, they probably would have won it. And that really felt like that really felt painful. Even the way the game ended, just that was a perfect symbol with the, there was a free kick for Napoli. They could have kicked it into the box. There wasn't enough time for Inter to just go back, even if they won the ball. And Unas was just so scared of kicking the ball up, he just held it. And so he took the draw. And that really made me angry, honestly, because Napoli were much, much better in that night. And as soon as they had allowed that one goal, they just got scared and they gave up on that game. Whereas the one with Cagliari was completely different, even though I know they weren't so far apart in time, but a lot of stuff happened in between. And Napoli had a lot of injuries between the two games. They had so many injuries, in fact, that against Cagliari, they had to switch for the second time this year to a 3-5-2 formation from the start. And they only had Koulibaly, Di Lorenzo, and Mario Rui as starters from their August setup, you know, the way their season was supposed to be set up. Everybody else was not a starter. And in fact, even of the other starters, only Fabian Ruiz and Osimhen were available, and only from the bench. And they only had about 15 or 20 minutes. Now, when you consider this, and you consider the super windy conditions, and you consider that Cagliari played in the Verona or Torino mold, where they suffocate you, they play man-to-man throughout the whole pitch, and Napoli were missing all their most physical men except for Petagna, you know, from the midfield on. They were missing Fabian, they were missing Osimhen, they were missing Anguissa, they were missing Lozano, who's not very athletic and gets away from you and gets a lot of fouls. They were missing all their best suited players for these conditions. It felt like it was going to be a defeat. And after Ospina made a terrible blunder to go down 1-0, I had basically no hope. And then seeing Napoli react actually gave me the opposite vibes from the previous week. You know, against Inter, they gave up when they were the better team. Against Cagliari, as soon as Fabian Ruiz and Osimhen came back on, they reacted and they got a goal. And in fact, in the last 20 minutes, just with those two on, adding a bit of physicality and athleticism, they looked like the better team. So that made me feel, you know, that it wasn't so much of a wasted opportunity. I mean, obviously it was a wasted opportunity, but it was more due to the fact that there were many injuries. It was the game right after the return of the European Cups. And we saw throughout Europe, teams struggling all over. I mean, in Italy, nobody won. So when you consider that, when you consider this, you know, I think Napoli have to celebrate the point they got against Cagliari, because when you look at the formation that Spalletti was forced to send out, it's a good draw. The one against the, I know it's totally counterintuitive because one is against Inter and the other one is against Cagliari. But you look at the teams, you look at the formation, you look at who was the better team starting the game, and they should have won against Inter, whereas against Cagliari, a lot of people were disappointed again because they had the chance to go on top. Spalletti himself was disappointed at the approach, and I agree with that. But the fact of the matter is, it was an uncustomary situation. It was an uncustomary formation. And I think getting 1 point there was actually pretty solid, pretty solid.
And yeah, you know what? Look, it's a lost opportunity too against Inter. You know, you have a chance to really make up some points. So I'm with you in that sense, right? I mean, it's just a lost opportunity there was even greater.
Well, they count you know, twice as much.
Double,
if you think
yeah.
About it. It's just as simple as that. But I'll tell you what, the Cagliari game just gave me a couple of good indications. I mean, the first one is that Napoli still do have some fight in them. And I questioned that at the end of the Inter game, to be honest, because I felt, you know, if you're going to quit or be so soft in such a big game, well, then maybe there's no fight left. There's no spirit left. But against Cagliari, I saw that spirit in the end. So that's the first thing, looking at the glass half full. And then there's another thing. And it, when, you know, on Patreon, we're going to talk about it with about Inter, about Milan as well, about the Scudetto races in total. But the thing is, whenever Napoli manages to have its starters healthy and on the pitch, it's a different team. I think it's been the best team in Serie A this year. Now, the problem is, Napoli had 42 injuries this year, 42. And while, you know, you can point out to the fact that maybe they botched the physical preparation because they've had 18 muscular injuries, which is a boatload, it's even scarier to think that they've had 24 non-muscular injuries. They've had 24 injuries that could not be forecast, including four injuries just to the head, with players getting elbowed or getting kicked in the head and just getting knocked down. Obviously, one of them was with Osimhen, and that was the casual one because it was head against head. But then three more players had that kind of injury. Lozano almost lost an eye, and we tend to forget that. And they've had so many injuries. And the problem is, you know, on one hand, I say, okay, if they get healthy, you know, they've proven that when they're healthy, they're the best team. On the other hand, when they went up against Inter, I think they only had two players out. Against Cagliari, at some point after Di Lorenzo had to go out through injury, they had 10 players out. So they lost 8 players in the span of 1 week. I mean, it's ridiculous. They're losing so many players consistently to just the most random injuries. And, you know, one gets a knock on the knee, the other one gets a knock on the ankle. Another guy gets 10 stitches in the forehead because he got elbowed. And it's just absolutely crazy. So I feel that Napoli might be the best team if they're healthy, but the question is, will they be healthy? And it looks like they won't be. And that is really going to make me suffer a lot, I'm telling you.
Well, look, starting lineup, Napoli is really, really impressive. And we're going to get to some of the players. But I'm going to ask you the same question I asked Daniele Mazzanti about Milan. We had him on a few weeks ago. And, you know, it feels that for a lot of the season, we kept circling January, the Africa Cup, what a big factor this is going to be in the Scudetto race. But at the end of the day, would you say it's fair to say maybe it wasn't that big of a factor overall? And how much would you say it ended up impacting Napoli at the end of the day?
You know, the fun thing is that people kept talking about that. And obviously, there was also an international break. So there was one fewer game than there should have been. But I feel that Napoli were so concerned about the African Cup that they actually got ready for it. They only lost 2 points, and that was in the Juventus-Napoli, which, you know, you can tie that game away at Juventus. And they won every other game during the African Cup. So they really didn't suffer for it because they planned for it. What really hurt Napoli were the previous 2 months in which they had so many injuries that it's incredible that they're there. I mean, if you think about it, they're level on points with Inter. They're only 2 points away from Milan with all the injuries they've had. It's incredible. It's absolutely unbelievable. Milan have had a lot of injuries themselves, not as many as Napoli, but they've had a lot. Whereas Inter, who always have been considered the best team in Serie A, they've almost been without a blemish. And you wonder what would have happened to Inter if they had just half the injuries that Milan or Napoli had, because they're over there level on points. And, you know, you can make that argument with all of the three. What if Napoli had stayed healthy all season long? What if Milan had? And what if Inter hadn't? Where would they be? But, you know, it's ifs and buts. The truth is they're there. The Scudetto is a wide open race. And I really feel that this year the Scudetto might be decided by the randomness of health, basically, because there's been so much variance between three teams. Milan have had a steady flux of injuries. Napoli had them all bunched up together. So Napoli were really healthy through the end of October, and they were absolutely dominating. Then they've had all the injuries together, and now it's starting again. Milan have never been 100% healthy, but they've also never had like 10 or 12 guys out at the same time like it happened to Napoli. And Inter have been healthy all season long. But then you wonder, can they keep it up, you know, if somebody starts getting hurt? And it doesn't look like they can. But at the same time, the fact that they did not get hurt makes you wonder, can they stay healthy the whole season? And if they can, they're probably still the favorites. So it's kind of a weird situation. We're going to go a little more in depth into this when we talk about those two teams, but that's how I feel for the Scudetto race. I think it's wide open, and I don't think it's really predictable because it's very random. You know, if you stay healthy, you win.
Fair. So the Africa Cup didn't end up really impacting him, but obviously the injury, and he's been back with a bang. And I have to tell you, I think between Vlahovic's big transfer to Juve and how it all started, I think people forgot how good Osimhen is. Do you agree with that? And do you think people are like, oh, wow, now that I'm seeing him and he's starting to get healthy again, now I remember why we consider this guy so good?
Yes, I mean, the media have been in love with somebody else for the last month or so, with a guy who had been already in Italy for about 2 years, and they hadn't really noticed him, apparently, and now he is the second coming of whoever you name. And, I think Vlahovic is the best player in Serie A, but I think he already was a month ago. He didn't just turn into that in the last 3 or 4 weeks. So regarding Osimhen, I think the media have forgotten about it, but also, yeah, it's a very fair point to say the fans did. Fans don't really have a long memory. And the thing is, Osimhen has already impacted against Cagliari, against Venezia, and he did that, you know, with headers. So this guy is so fearless that he's still wearing a mask. You know, he still isn't 100% all right. And he's just going into aerial duels and winning them, decisive ones. And yes, of course, it makes you feel, you know, what could have been if he had stayed healthy the whole season long. You can see it, especially in games like the one against Cagliari, you know, which get very, very physical. Because Petagna is a decent substitute, but, I mean, it's easy to neutralize him. And Mertens, in those games, he becomes, you know, a lost man because he can still invent a bit of magic in other games, but not when it gets physical. So having a guy like Osimhen would have really made a huge difference. And people forgot the impact that he can have, but he showed that he can have it even in just 20 or 30 minutes. Now, of course, he's still not a finished product. He's still not perfect. Games like the one against Barcelona show it. He can't find the spot. He doesn't know where to go, or, you know, he still doesn't make the right choices at all times. But he's so incredibly superior from any athletic standpoint, and he's got so much strength that once he improves his decision-making, and here we're not talking about improving his skill or his talent or his technique, I'm just saying improving his decision-making, I think, you know, he's going to make even more of a difference. I don't think he's going to become as good as Erling Haaland and probably not even as good as Vlahovic, but you know how much I'm in love with Vlahovic.
Yeah.
But he's going to be right on their heels, right behind them, you know, in the next year of outstanding forwards of this generation.
Yeah, well, look, you know, I know we did that ranking over and over again of the top young strikers in Serie A. I love Vlahovic, but I still give Osimhen a slight edge. But I want to ask you about players.
Awesome. You know, the thing is, I voted for Vlahovic. I'm a Napoli fan.
I know you've been very consistent for sure.
I'm not going to change it just because he went to Juventus. Now, sure, I'm going to hope he hits the post instead of slotting it in now. But I still think he's such an incredible player, and I got to give credit to that.
For sure. So I want to ask you about Lobotka, because I don't think we've talked about him. I know we've talked about Romani, but I want to ask you about Lobotka because he's been really, really excellent. I feel like Spalletti has gotten a lot out of him. And in a way, Romani was the same two guys that were almost forgotten under Gattuso. So between the two, who has surprised you more this season, Lobotka or Romani?
You can make an argument for both, but I will still say Romani. And the reason is that Lobotka, even though it was just a one season off, he already had a season in which he was absolutely superlative. And that was the first one he had in Spain with Celta Vigo. It was just absolutely incredible. I still remember that. And that's why Napoli got him and paid so much for him. Now, I was not too happy when that happened because it had been just one season. Now, it did mean on one hand that he had it in him, but on the other hand, it was just one season. With Rahmani, he didn't even have that season. I mean, he was good with Verona, but he was in a different system and he wasn't nearly this good. So for him to step up at age 27 and play in a starting role next to Koulibaly and sometimes even outplaying Koulibaly. And remember, Napoli have the second best defense in the whole of Europe and by far the best in Serie A. And in no short part, because he's been so incredibly excellent. And that one really came out of nowhere. I thought he could be a good substitute, but never to this level. Whereas with Lobotka, you know, first of all, he already had a season like that in the past. So that's one more than Rahmani had. And also there is the fact that Spalletti seems to get the best out of these players, you know, the players who play in midfield right in front of defense. He's done that with Fabian Ruiz. We can talk about him. He's done that in the past with Pizarro. He's done that in the past with Brozovic. I mean, Brozovic was always a talented player, but with Spalletti, he took a step up. I mean, he turned from a talented player who hadn't really found, you know, as we say in Italy, la quadratura del cerchio. He hadn't really found his, I don't want to say position or role, but there was always something imperfect that he was trying to, you know, make more perfect, either in terms of role or position or whatever. With Spalletti, he became the best center midfielder in Italy, or maybe one of the top three, probably. And again, so having a guy like that at Napoli with those characteristics just blossom should not be so much of a surprise. But Rahmani, there was absolutely no indication that he could be this good. And right now, I mean, I would still peg him as a starter next year. There's absolutely no reason for Napoli to substitute him. You just need another bench guy instead of him.
For sure. So I'm going to ask you about Almas, who I've liked for a while, and it seems Spalletti has had a good influence on him. If you had to guess, do you think Almas is a starter on Napoli next season?
He could be, depending on where Napoli decide to spend their money, if they go into Champions League, the budget they're going to have, and so on. But I honestly hope he's not, because I think he gives so much to the team in this versatile role. You know, he is one of the two players with Di Lorenzo who has featured in every game this year. So he's already a starter. The only thing is that he's not always starting in the same positions, and most of the times he's coming off the bench. But he is one of the two players, and that includes the goalkeepers. So he's one of the two players who's played every game. So he's already an important player, but I think this role suits him best, especially because he's a very consistent player. Like, his last two or three games have been really, really poor. And so having him off the bench and not having to rely on him to play with consistency, I think, is the best role. He's going to have an impact like that even in the future. As a starter, I think Napoli have to aim for someone who's a little better and a little more consistent.
Fair. So we've talked a lot about Anguissa on the pod, and I know you like American sports. I'm not sure how familiar you are with hockey. There is a role called the goon, which is kind of the protector of the star player and like hits the other guys and kind of protects the star player. And I feel like Anguissa really helped Fabian Ruiz. I mean, I thought for a while at the start of the season, Fabian Ruiz was just bawling. Would you say overall this has been his best season at Napoli? I mean, I think at bare minimum, it's safe to say he's bounced back after, you know, pretty mediocre phase for him.
Yeah, I think it's his best season. His first season is his second best season. Then he had two pretty mediocre seasons under Gattuso. I think it's in part, though, due to the coaches. And in part due to Anguissa, because he started as a mezzala under Ancelotti, with Spalletti playing right in front of the defense but with an enforcer basically next to him, right? And I think this really, again, with Spalletti, if you're a playmaker in front of defense, you usually do well. So it was a perfect marriage and a perfect wedding, and it worked wonderfully. And I think he's also been motivated by the fact that, you know, he was kind of cruising. Happy to with his role. He was starting for the Spanish national team, wasn't playing too well, but he was happy like that. And then all of a sudden he lost after the European Championships. He lost the spot on the national team. And I think that served him as a wake-up call. That and Spalletti and Anguissa. It was a perfect storm all of a sudden. And now he's playing for a contract as well, because his contract is expiring in 2023. So either he's going to get a big renewal from Napoli or he's going to get sold. But either way, he's going to get paid this summer. And so it's a perfect storm for him. And he's showing us the best football of his life. I think he's been absolutely, not just the beginning of the season. I think the biggest struggles for Napoli were when he went down. Because until then, Napoli kind of kept afloat. Then against Sassuolo, he went down, and Napoli without him, they couldn't beat even like Spezia, for example, or Empoli. So, and same against Cagliari. Napoli were incredibly struggling. He came on. Sure, it was also Osimhen, but I felt he came on, he just controlled, he bossed the midfield, and I think he really changed things over there. So I think alongside Koulibaly and Osimhen, he is the most important player this year for Napoli, and he's had an incredible impact, even though I think, you know, he's having such a great impact that it might be his last months with Napoli.
Yeah, I think he's, you know, if I had to do an ideal starting 11 of Serie A this season, he's definitely in the midfield for me. I want to ask you about another, well, this guy has more of an expiring contract than Fabian Ruiz, and that's Ospina. We've been talking how, you know, he's become the clear starter over Murray. Maybe this isn't the best time to ask after the Cagliari game, but look, overall, I think he's been an asset for Napoli this season. So what do you make of his performances overall? And if you had to guess, do you think he'll be the starter? Starting keeper for Napoli next season?
I think he's been excellent, to be honest. I mean, obviously, after the game against Cagliari, it's not the right moment to say that. But he's been excellent. The thing is, with Gattuso, it was different. I think it was more that Gattuso didn't want a young goalkeeper, and it kind of made me a little angry. But under Spalletti, I think he's earned his chance, and he's played it beautifully. There's absolutely no reason for Spalletti to play Meret, because Ospina has been just superlative, even as a shot stopper. In the past, I mean, he was great at coming out for crosses, coming out for low balls. He was great with his feet, but the shot stopping was kind of average. I feel this year, except for the last game, he's been superlative. So, you know, he's earned it. Now, for next year, it's kind of a different thing. He's got an important contract. He's 33 going on 34. And I think Napoli are going to move on. And he's going to probably, you know, take that veteran bench role on one of the big teams. Real Madrid were mentioned for him. He could be a solid backup to Courtois at Real Madrid. And I think that would be the best for everybody. It makes sense. It doesn't really make sense to renew a 34-year-old goalkeeper, even if he's doing well, because you're going to have to give him at least a 2-year contract. And there's a chance that he gets a 3-year contract with the way he's been playing. And that's a little too risky for Napoli. So I think he's earned it. He's been great. He's been an asset. He's been a leader. but I think his contract is going to expire in the summer, and the club and him, they're going to leave each other with a handshake and happy with what they've accomplished together, but I think it's coming to an end.
Yeah, look, he's been without a doubt a very solid player for Napoli. Okay, so you kind of, you know, we've been talking a lot about this crazy Scudetto race that can come down to health, which sounds, you know, pretty fair. But we have to also surging Juve. We've talked about Vlahovic. Who knows? Your friend Sarri's been doing okay at Lazio recently. Fiorentina's look good. But Juve, to me, look like the candidate to break in the top four. So with that in mind, and Napoli hasn't been in the Champions League, you know, it would be good to get back. If I gave you the option right now to sign for a top four finish, would you take it?
No. No. I mean, unless it's the first spot. I mean, the first spot is in the top four. So
okay,
I guess
so
I would.
Second through but fourth. Then. Okay,
no, fair. No. No, you only live once. And I mean, it's almost March, and Napoli are 2 points off the lead, and they have to host the leaders in their own stadium. I mean, if at this point you wave the white flag, why are you even playing? What are we even playing for? Why are you even starting the
you
league?
You play to win the game, like Herm Edwards would say.
You've got to. Especially a club that doesn't really have a history of winning the league. We've won a lot of cups, but we have not won the league ever without Maradona. And even with him, we've only won it twice. So you've got to do it. I mean, the thing is, even with Sarri, Napoli were only once in a better position than right now. So, and that Napoli was considered the best Napoli since Maradona. You could make an argument it was or it wasn't, but even they have only been once in a better situation. And guess what? They had a tougher opponent than this version of Milan or this version of Inter. So, obviously, you've got to shoot for it. You've got to try. So, no, I'm not signing for anything. You've got to try to win. And then if you don't, that's fair, you know. Sometimes you win, sometimes you lose, sometimes you draw. It doesn't matter. But you got to try. There is absolutely no way that in February I'm waving the white flag. Even if
I love it. I love it. No, I think that is absolutely the right answer. Okay, so let's close on this. And I have you obviously know very well what's going on with Napoli and all. So I don't know if this is like a Pep Guardiola to Juve Twitter thing that happened, this buzz on Amazon potentially buying Napoli, the club, but also doing a big distribution center there. So A, do you give any credence to those rumors? And B, obviously we've seen a lot of you know, clubs being sold, especially at American owners. But do you see ADL being De Laurentiis being interested in potentially selling to a foreign owner, even if it were an Amazon?
Well, let's start from the last one. Yes, absolutely. I mean, De Laurentiis is over 70 and he's reached the maximum of his potential. He's lost a lot of money during the pandemic. Obviously, Napoli had money reserves, so it wasn't too tough on them. But the thing is, they obviously had to go get those reserves, and they lost most of those reserves that I'm sure De Laurentiis would have loved to keep for himself. So obviously, you know, all these things considered, and he's also very unhappy with the football governance, and we could talk 3 days about that. You know, the Italian football isn't exactly well run. Right now, the Italian league doesn't even have a president. So you cannot blame him for that if he decided to sell Napoli. I think he would be very glad to sell it if he got a good offer. The problem is, in all these years, there's never been a really good offer. Never. And why? Because, you know, when you buy a soccer club or a football club, whatever you want to call it, it's more than just, especially when you're buying top-level clubs, not with all due respect, we're not talking about Salernitana or Spezia or those clubs. We're talking about a club that's going to cost over half a billion. You're making an investment that's a lot more complicated than people make it out to be. I mean, just think of how hard it has been for Pallotta, for Friedkin, for Commisso, for Elliott, for Zhang, to just do stuff with the stadium, which would be a key part of anybody's investment coming from outside. And if they don't think they can legitimately keep the stadium and do whatever they need to do with it or build a new one, which is a really tough proposition in Italy, especially in the big cities. Because, of course, I mean, with all due respect to Atalanta, Bergamo isn't exactly a big city. Udine isn't exactly a big city. Reggio Emilia, where Sassuolo play, is not a big city. In fact, it's not even Sassuolo. Sassuolo don't play in their own city. That's funny, but it is true. And obviously, if somebody has to make an investment that goes beyond $500 million, they'll want some guarantees that nobody's willing to give them. So it is tough to raise the level at this point. And so I think De Laurentiis would be very happy to sell. I'm just not sure whoever would want to buy Napoli right now. And in fact, let's remember one thing, though. De Laurentiis has to sell either Napoli or Bari.
Yeah, at some point. Yeah.
26 months from now. 26 months from now, there's a deadline, or else he's going to lose one of the two teams, like Lotito lost Salernitana for only 10 million. And I'm sure De Laurentiis doesn't want that. So if anybody came in with an offer, with a really suitable offer, north of $500 million, probably more like 600 or 700 million, because remember, Atalanta just sold 55% of it with a valuation that was close to 400. So obviously Napoli has to go over 600, probably. Maybe over, well, I don't want to say 700. You would have to study a lot of stuff, but there's no debt there. The city is huge.
Yeah.
There are a lot of fans internationally. If Atalanta goes for that number, Napoli certainly goes for over $500 million. But again, who spends over $500 million without guarantees to invest all around? And you know that politicians in Italy are going to make it an issue. So at this point, you know, one thing is to do it in a city like Milan or like Rome, where you can still get collateral revenue if you're good at it, even without that, just because you market the city. And with Naples, even though Naples is a tourist city, is an important city, for foreigners, it's not quite Milan or Rome. We got to face it. So either you make it palatable to investors by giving them something, either the possibility of building a new stadium, or you give them the stadium and let them do whatever they want, or it's going to be really hard. And again, I think De Laurentiis looks very tired right now. He looks very tired. He's lost a lot of fight. He had a lot more fight. He had a lot more competitiveness. I think he's been a different man since the mutiny. He's been very quiet. He's been low-key and everything. Yeah. And I think he's tired. So if any offer comes in, I think he'd be willing to give it. Now, we're talking about Jeff Bezos. It's not the first time it comes out. The other times, it was always bollocks, okay? It was always BS, always. I don't see why this time it wouldn't be, especially because, all due respect, the source is very dubious, okay? And it's before Bezos, it was always a sheikh, an emir, somebody from the Middle East. Because obviously you want to fire up the family.
Yeah.
You know, you hope that there's some pressure on him to sell, but there's no offer. That's the problem. And the question is, Bezos is now becoming a player. And tonight we're actually speaking. We should say that there was just right now a game on Amazon Prime Video. Bezos is much more interested right now in TV rights.
Agreed.
Than buying teams.
Yeah, for sure.
So why on earth, especially a guy like him, who is not a mid-level investor, a guy like him would buy, first of all, a club in Italy, okay? You probably would go to the Premier League if you wanted to buy a club. And you could afford it for sure. That's the first thing.
Yeah, I mean, if he can't afford it, yeah, who does? Sure.
Right, exactly. So he could go into the Premier League. Why on earth would he go to Italy? And the second thing is, why would he go in Naples? They say, oh, because he's building an exchange spot. Yeah, guess what? There's one. There are like three or four of them in Italy. And what would it make a difference? Why would it make a difference to have a team close to exchange spots in Italy? What difference would it make? It would make a difference, surely, if he had the possibility to maybe do what Pallotta wanted to do in Rome. Pallotta basically wanted to build an entire district. Now, if Bezos had that possibility, that would be different. But guess what? This is just what we've been talking about. Right now, it's a huge issue, even just to rebuild the stadium, let alone an entire district. So if there's no possibility to do that, why would he do that? And also, if he did that, it would probably make it impossible for him to compete for the TV rights. So it just does not make sense from any point of view, even though, you know, I hope there's something beneath it because I'm an irrational fan. You know, I am rational as a person, but as a fan, I am irrational. So obviously, I hope there's something beneath it. Maybe, you know, there's a part of me that hopes that he's been meeting with the mayor and the mayor gave him reassurances, you know, yeah, we're going to make you build an entire district. You can do whatever you want and so on. And in that case, it would make sense. But unless all of these things are lining up behind the scenes, and it's very unlikely looking at Italy, not just at Naples, but looking at the whole of Italy. Well, in that case, you know, it's not going to happen. As simple as that.
All right. So that was great stuff. So if you enjoyed this podcast, you know, consider becoming a patron. You'll hear a Napoli Outsider once a month. Sometimes we just do patron and we go deep for a while. It's a great segment. We have great other stuff. If you don't want to become a patron, that's fine too. If you enjoyed the show, please retweet it. Give us 5 stars on Spotify and leave a comment on iTunes.
So on top of hearing Napoli Outsider once a month chatting calcio with me, our patrons also get to ask questions both on Tuesday on the Friday pod. So now let's get to them. It's a great community of like-minded calcio fans. So if you're looking to get more calcio content, consider joining them.
With the new year, one of my goals was to bring in some exciting new guests from Italy. We've had two that have been really, really awesome so far, but I saved the third one for a really special guest. So to give you some background on Giuseppe Pastore, who's hopping on for the first time on Calcioland, about this time last year, I started following him on Twitter, and I really, really loved his account because he had so many historical stats and facts about the league that really resonated to me. If you follow, you know, Mr. Chips on Twitter, it's kind of like that, but Giuseppe has his own Italian spin on it, which is awesome. And then I started reading his articles, especially on Rivista Undici. And, you know, I could really tell that this is a guy that really, really has incredible knowledge of calcio. And the reason I wanted to have him on is on top of having what I think is one of the very best calcio accounts in Italian on Twitter. He's also coming out with a book, which is coming out, I think, tomorrow, actually. We're recording this on Wednesday, on the great Milan between 86 and 94. So the early phase of the Berlusconi phase, which to me is the best Italian team I've ever seen. So this is why I wanted to have Giuseppe on, talk a little bit about the book, talk a little bit about the awesome stats that we have. And then on top of it all, Giuseppe is also big, big movie buff. And if you know me, you know that's right up my alley. So we're going to talk movies at the end as well. For those not familiar with Giuseppe, on top of being the author of the upcoming book In Milan Col Sole in Tasca, he's a journalist for Il Foglio in Italy, Esquire Italia, L'Inchiesta, and Rivista Undici, where he really, really has some great stuff. So Giuseppe, it's a real honor for me to welcome you to the podcast. Benvenuto to Calcioland.
Hi, David. Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for the presentation. Wonderful, wonderful introduction.
Well, you deserve it. You deserve it. So let's start here, Giuseppe, because you are the master of the stats, the facts about calcio, and you tweet things that, you know, are really, really interesting. So tell me about it. What makes a particular stat or fact particularly memorable to you and worthy of sharing with your followers?
A lot of things. I think a lot of things. A random fact, a random culture fact that can be funny, can be strange, can be unbelievable, can be weird too. I'll make an example. One of my favorite stats, one of my favorite random facts is that about Antoine Griezmann. Has 3 children, Antoine Griezmann. All of them were born on the 8th of April. Incredible, unbelievable. It's something that we can't even imagine, but it's true, it's reality. I love this kind of stuff. I strongly believe in coincidence, in connections between the present and the past. For example, next Friday, it will be a match, Milan Udinese in San Siro. It will be exactly 10 years from one of the most controversial facts in Italian football, like Gol di Montari.
Oh, yeah.
2012, 25 of February on 2012. Next Friday will be 25th of February in 2022, 10 years ago. Milan again in San Siro, again against a team who had a black and white shirt. So it's the complexity of life, of that we find every day in this kind of stuff.
I love it. So tell me, you do tweet a lot of different type of facts and all. Mm. Are there some that it surprises you and you're like, okay, let me tweet this, but then you get a lot of responses and people are like, wow, this is really crazy. Is there a type of fact that surprises you that it becomes popular?
This is a very funny question because I still don't understand the mental mechanism that makes some tweets, some facts more popular than others. It's like when you, when a singer, when a pop star makes a series of hits and he just don't know what of these tunes will be more popular than others. It's something in the air, maybe. I found all this very funny. I think that on social media, there are two things equally important, imagination and timing. Be fast, don't be banal. You can have the most genial idea of the history of Twitter, of social media, but if you don't write it at the right time, it becomes totally useless.
Yeah.
Obviously, good journalism is not just that. It's about facts. It's about fairness with the audience, clarity of thought. It's like a cocktail. When you have all of them, you can add a bit of imagination, a bit of timing, and you have the perfect fact, the perfect tweet, the perfect post. Put it when how you want, but. I think we need this kind of thing, all these things to make the perfect Prestige, as the movie of Christopher Nolan.
the perfect analogy.
Yeah.
Love it. No, and you're really, really good at this. There's no doubt about it. So let's talk. This is actually perfect timing. We had discussed last week to have you on, and then we had really a really crazy weekend in Serie A. So we're coming off a weekend in which none of the top seven teams in the standings won a game. You did that research. That hadn't happened in quite some time. So on top of, you know, being great at random facts, like you're an astute observer of the game. So I want to ask you too, what do you think the reason is that this season feels particularly random and that, you know, we have all these clusters of teams at the top. We thought Inter was maybe going to take off and they didn't. And now it feels like, you know, that no one wants to win the Scudetto maybe as much as hosting the Oscars. They had a really hard time finding someone for that. It feels like winning the Scudetto is just as hard. So why do you think the reason is this season feels so particularly random?
You in last weekend we have none of the top seven teams won, but also there were not matches between them, so it's seven different matches, so it's more surprising too. I think that all top seven, eight teams of the league now are dramatically tired. The tiredness of all the physically tired, the mentally tired. Above all, in Italy, last two seasons, with all these close matches, one after the other, every 3 days match in Serie A, all matches are very strong. All teams are very tactical, prepared. As we know, we saw last weekend, Salernitana, Cagliari against Naples. Last two seasons in Italy have been very hard and tiring. There is a very high mental pressure on every team, on Inter Milan because they are defending champion, on AC Milan because they didn't win in the last 10 years anything. Juventus, obviously. Also, Naples, also AS Roma. there are some places in Italy in which you are doomed to win. And if you don't win two or three matches in a row, it's the apocalypse.
Yeah.
For example, this is the situation of AS Roma. They bought Mourinho in this season, but they are seventh, eighth place. So Mourinho tried to make noise to make the people watching from another part of the picture, because the situation is complicated too. Juventus too, with this kind of reason or discussion makes sense for Juventus too. So for a team, it's very difficult to improve itself. Now it's just a matter of staying afloat. In Italy, yeah. Italian is the best language in the world, in my opinion. In Italy, we have a wonderful word, a wonderful verb. It's barcamenarsi. Stay on the boat in some way, in the storm, remaining afloat.
Just hold on no matter what. I like it. That's a great word.
Barcamenarsi. Now you have just to survive, especially because there's not a dominating team as Inter Milan last season or Juventus for 9 years in a row. So everybody can win, but this brings pressure. Simone Inzaghi, Luciano Spalletti, Stefano Pioli, the three managers of Inter, Naples, and AC Milan, none of them have ever won Italian League. So you understand the pressure on these guys. And yeah, it will be the same until the end of the season.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. The players are incredibly tired. And I think you also, I like that you highlighted the mental. It's not just, and it's, yeah, a lot of injuries for sure. And yeah, the pressure in Italy, like you highlighted, especially at Roma, really is something else. So you are obviously a big calcio historian. Is there a season, you know, in the past 30, 40 years or so that kind of reminds you of this particular season we are going through?
Yeah, I thought about this two, three days ago when I saw the poor draw against Salernitana of AC Milan. Salernitana is the bottom of the league, the worst team in the league 3 weeks ago. But they are have a sort of rebirth with new manager Davide Nicola. The season I remember is 98-99, the season after World Cup 98 in France. There was a lot of stars at the time in Italy. There was the same confusion in the top of the table, a lot of overtakings, epic fails, big surprise, big injuries too. At the start of the season, we had Inter Milan with the best striker of the world, Ronaldo, the Brazilian, Ronaldo il Fenomeno, as we say in Italy, in a very poor form after the World Cup, the infamous incident before the final with France. Inter out. We had Juventus, Champions League finalist, defending champion, but they lost Del Piero because of an injury in November.
Yeah.
Juve out. We had Parma with Buffon, Cannavaro, Thuram, Crespo, Chiesa, Verona, the winners of UEFA Cup, Coppa Italia, but they just didn't have the constancy of results. It was an ambient, an environment very... Too relaxed to win in Italy, Emilia Romagna. So a best place to live in, but not to fight for the title. We had Fiorentina with Battistuta, best striker of the league, but injured himself in February. Fiorentina out. We had Lazio with Vieri, Mancini, Mihajlovic, Nedved, and they engaged a strong duel against AC Milan. But absolutely, AC Milan wasn't the best team in the league, but they had George Weah, Paolo Maldini, Oliver Bierhoff, Boban, but they won because stayed in the right place at the right time. They were ready to carpe diem, to seize the day.
Yeah.
And they won. Maybe this year will be the same. We have three strong teams, Inter, AC Milan, Naples, but they all have flaws. It will be very important, the mental strength.
I agree. And I'll tell you, the reason why I've been very bullish on Inter all season is because, as you said, every team is flawed. But I think the fact that they brought back most players that won the Scudetto, I think, is a big edge. But maybe I'm overrating that because Inter has certainly struggled recently. So let's stay on Inter. We recently had Inter hosting Liverpool. I think you had an analysis that I completely agree with. It felt like Liverpool for 70 minutes were just waiting, and when they wanted to accelerate and do some damage, they could. I felt like Inter played as good a game as they probably could for 70 minutes, and they really just had one shot on goal. So do you think this game illustrates like the big difference, the growing gap between the Premier League and Serie A? Because even if you don't think Inter is the best team in Italy, they certainly are the best offense in Italy, and they got just one shot on goal on Liverpool. So what do you think that game says about the gap between Premier League and Serie A?
We have two Italian teams in the top 16 of Champions League, but they, Inter and Juventus, shot just two times in two matches against Liverpool and Villarreal. These stats, I enlarge the point of view of these stats. Yesterday, Juventus shot just two times in goal against Villarreal. Both shots were taken by Dusan Vlahovic, so just one single player had shots in goal in two matches. Which is the best striker of the league, obviously. Inter-Liverpool, above all, gave the sensation of inferiority on all plans, technical plan, physical and tactical too. You get right. When Klopp decided to win, he won, because Jurgen Klopp won the match, changing three players at 60th minute. He put Henderson, Keita, before he put Firmino, and he won the game. Three top players that gave him the chance to improve his team, while the substitutions of Inter Milan made the team worse. This is a chronicle flaw of Inter. Every guy goes into the match in second half is poorer than who exit of the game. In a derby, in Inter Milan, Simone Inzaghi took off Perisic, MVP of the match, and Inter lost the match. So this is the biggest difference, a very deep squad between Italian League and English League. Italian deep squads, better players, and definitely more money, obviously.
Well, let's talk about an Italian team that I think would have more than held their own against Liverpool and maybe probably would have won that game. So your book is we're recording this on Wednesday. Your book is coming out on the 24th. It's called Il Milan col sole in tasca. I'm a big fan of titles, and that is a great title. It's Milan with sunlight in their back pocket, or the sunshine in their pocket. Really, really great title. I dig it. So tell us, and I agree with you. Unlike you, I didn't grow up a Milan fan, but in Padova, Milan's a huge deal, and most of my friends are diehard Milanisti. I remember that team. I remember when they won the first Champions League against Steaua Bucharest. That was just an incredible performance. So tell our listeners a little bit why you consider this Milan from 86 to 94 to be the strongest Italian team we've ever had.
And maybe not just Italian, because a lot of international magazines put that team in top three club teams all time, with Ajax in the 70s and Real Madrid in the 50s, or Barcelona, Pep Guardiola's Barcelona 10 years ago. Above all, AC Milan is the best Italian team ever because Arrigo Sacchi changed the game. I mean, an example. It's like when you go to Las Vegas and find a way to beat the dealers in blackjack. You force them to change the rules because you have found a way to break those rules. So Arrigo Sacchi made with offside, with all these defensive strategies that were a start point to dominate the game. Dozens of great managers inspired themselves to that squad, Rafa Benitez, Jurgen Klopp, everyone said. And then there was a megalomaniac genius, Silvio Berlusconi, dropped on football a lot of money, billions, billions, billions. He bought the best players in the world. At one point, for AC Milan, played three different Ballon d'Or: Marco Van Basten, Ruud Gullit, Jean-Pierre Papin, Ben Baresi, Maldini, Frankie Rijkaard, Dejan Savicevic, the all-star game, but in the same team. All this mixed with political issues, economical issues, cultural issues, because in the 80s, Italy was the fourth country in the world, economically stronger than England. So, you know, it's all connected. And in this book, there is not just the history of a wonderful team, of a wonderful football team, or the history of Italian football, but the history of a whole country, because Italy changed deeply in six, seven years, from 86 to 94. It happened a lot of things, bad things, good things. In this book, they all are narrated, said. And I hope that it will be a funny book, but also an interesting book, because it's the history of our country, our nation, against football. In Italy, football is absolutely a metaphor of life.
Oh, for sure. No, I love what you said. And, you know, when you mentioned Papin, you know, it makes me, I chatted with Alex Frazzi on the podcast, and I told him I thought the apex of Italian football was like in the 80s, when you had players like Junior at Torino, Socrates at Fiorentina, Zico at Udinese. And his comeback was like, well, in the 90s, Papin wasn't even really a starter at Milan when he arrived. That's how good that team was. So definitely for Milan, that was the apex. So one more thing on the book. I love the cover. And on your tweet, you know, talking about this, you said that one of the goal of the book is to kind of those who are very knowledgeable on Milan, and the cover has Van Basten wearing number 16. And back then the players were 1 to 11, 16 was coming off the bench. That was usually a striker. I remember that game. So I remember, it makes sense to me why, but I think someone sees that cover, wasn't that familiar, is like, why is Van Basten wearing 16? So tell us a little bit why you guys decided to go with the cover, which, just like the title, I find completely brilliant.
It's a sort of trivia for the readers. I discovered that the youngest football fans in Italy, those who have 15 or 20 years old, simply don't know that there was a time in which players have not personalized numbers, but played every time with numbers from 1 to 11. And they might change every time. So in this picture, Marco Van Basten wears number 16 because he starts from the bench, then he entered at the halftime for Donadoni, then he scored one of the most important goals in the history of Milan with number 16, assist by Ruud Gullit against Naples in Stadio San Paolo against Diego Maradona, so and so. All the readers will recognize immediately the picture. Younger readers will ask themselves, why this number? Why this strange number? Obviously, they find the answer inside the book. It's like when you watch a movie set in 80s or in the 70s. Who lived that epoch will recognize every detail. In Italy, we have a wonderful movie by Paolo Sorrentino, At the End of God, who is nominated in foreign film at the Oscar, who is set in the 80s in Naples. So I was a child in the 80s. In the 90s, I recognized immediately a lot of details, a lot of hints he put for audience. But there are also younger spectators who don't know nothing about that period. So it's a double key of interpretation of the opera that is so interesting. I think that in this book, in my small area of I think that it will be the same thing.
I love it. Great analogy. It is a great movie, man. This year, the best foreign picture is absolutely stacked, though. I don't think he's going to win, but it is a great movie for sure. But before we talk a little bit more about movies, because we have that passion in common too, I have to ask you about Bajo, because as I was getting ready for the interview, I read your recent article on Bajo's time in Brescia. And look, you know, I grew up in Italy in the 80s, although I grew up in Padova, and Bajo just from Vicenza, I absolutely idolize him. I think he's without a doubt the best Italian forward I've seen in my life. I think he's a full notch above Del Piero, which pains me, and Totti too. I just think the world of Baggio, but also the type of guy that he is. Like, he really has a pretty peculiar personality, to say the least. And I think in your article, you captured that really well about his time in Brescia. So what about Baggio in that phase really stands out to you, and what do you remember it for?
I wrote that article last week for Roberto Baggio's birthday, 55 years. I adored Roberto Baggio when I was a child. I have a lot of wonderful memories about this, about him, about these three World Cups, about, above all, USA 94, when he got the team off the plane to Italy, when, as we said, till then, and it took us to the final against Brazil. The last 4 years of his career, the final chapter, the last dance, he went to Brescia, a small team with no ambition to win the title or go in Champions League, out of competition, out of pressure, out of poisons of victory or at all costs, and there he made the magic. I recommend you go to YouTube, digit Baggio Brescia, and have a good fun. He's a wonderful guy. He's completely out of fashion, out of showbiz. He just don't care about this kind of things. He lives in a small town in Veneto with his family. He made 3-4 interviews in a year, so he had no interest to appear, to be on social media, to be on TV. It's a wonderful man, a wonderful example of you can survive to your greatness. We have a lot of examples, as for example Buffon or Totti, who made a big have a big problem to stop their career. Buffon too is still playing in Parma, who is 14th or 15th in Serie B. Roberto Baggio stopped his career at the top of the of his parabola, as we say in Italy, of his journey as a sportsman. He knew when it was over. It's a great quality for an athlete, I think. Many athletes don't know, or they just struggle to compete, to continue, because they feel they are dead if they stop. It was not the case of Roberto Baggio, a wonderful man, a wonderful athlete. So I think he is an example of life, not just of sport, of life.
I totally agree. And look, you know, I consider myself very fortunate to have grown up in Veneto in the 80s and early 90s. And he really has the qualities that I associated with that region and the people there. Yeah. So very well said. I love the article because, you know, I feel like I know a lot about Baggio, and I learned a lot reading it there. So great job on Calcio. Now let's talk about movies, because I know you are very passionate about this. Your avatar is Mr. Wolf from Pulp Fiction. So I want to start here. You know, Tarantino's made 9 movies, a lot of amazing characters. If you say Mr. Wolf, that's fine too. But who is your favorite Tarantino character ever, and why?
Mr. Wolf. I have to say Mr. Wolf is my avatar on Twitter and WhatsApp too. Mr. Wolf, I solve problems. It's an amazing character because we don't know anything about him. Why is so well dressed at 9 o'clock in the morning? Why is always so confident, so cool? But Quentin Tarantino knows that mystery about the character is the best way to love him. So I loved to Hans Landa. He's a Nazi, he's a poor guy, he's a badass. Therefore, he's perfect badass because in the movie is greater as we have the biggest plan. So Christoph Waltz, a wonderful actor, is perfect in that role. I can say I love that guy, that character, but I love the tone of the movie that made that character brilliant. So I love Mr. Wolf, but I love too Mr. Landa, for example. One another character, well, every Tarantino movie has a lot of wonderful characters. How can I say? I love Jackie Brown.
Yeah.
One of the best female characters in the history of movies. I love Beatrix Uma Thurman in The Bride in Kill Bill. It's difficult choose is difficult.
Yeah, well, you had some great picks, though, there, for sure. Yeah, no, I have to say, Inglourious Basterds, the more time passes, the more I think is Tarantino's biggest achievement. Because, I mean, he's an amazing writer. And to do that in different languages like that and the character, like, really, really amazing. So great call there. So last week, you had an awesome thread on David Lynch, Mulholland Drive. I think it's just an incredible movie. And I think for Lynch's standards, it's actually somewhat straightforward. And I think on your thread, you really nailed the plot of that movie. But is that your favorite Lynch movie? And if so, why? Or is there another that you like just as much, if not more?
Yeah, is it? It is. Mulholland Drive is one of my top three favorite movies in all time with Once Upon a Time in America by Sergio Leone and Talk to Her by Pedro Almodovar. Mulholland Drive is wonderful because it's Anatomy of Dream. An encyclopedia of dreams. It shows you how dreams work, how frightening they can be, how exhilarating they can be, how incomprehensible they can be, and why they can be this way. It's a wonderful movie directed by a genius, and I think too that it's the most logical and most geometrical of his movies. There are a lot of Lynch movies that are simply a mess. Land Empire, Lost Highways, Eraser Red, his first movie. This is, Mulholland Drive is the most bright, most logical of his movies. And maybe people watching it for the first time thinks, oh my God, it's so complicated, it's a mess. No, you have watched it two or three times to appreciate him in his greatness. So I watched it five, six, seven times, I think. It's always best every time I watch it.
Yeah, you know, what I always advise people that are getting into Lynch, I always tell them, try to experience it rather than understand. Like, if you focus so much the first few times trying to understand it, you're kind of missing the point, just experiencing it. And, you know, I feel like, you know, there was some reaction on, oh, the plot of Mulholland Drive is complicated. And then he came back with Inland Empire, which really has no plot whatsoever. And he was like, oh, I'll show you something that's really crazy. So let's close on this, Giuseppe. If you are on a desert island with little hope of getting back to civilization, you can have just one movie director's filmography to keep you company on this desert island. Which director's filmography do you pick and why?
I choose two. I put it on the same line. I should say Pulp Fiction or Once Upon a Time in America too. Because they contain everything. Because there is love, friendship, death, sex, betrayal, dreams, money, a big metaphor of life. As football, these two movies too are everything. Are omnicomprehensive. I would never get tired of watching them because every time I watch them, I discover new details. suggestions, new emotions. I think they are the two movies I watched the most times in my life.
Awesome. Great choice. Well, Giuseppe, I can't thank you enough. I had a blast chatting culture with you and movies. So by the time you guys hear this podcast, the book will be out, Il Milan col sole in tasca. I'm going to be in Italy soon. I cannot wait to get my hands on it. So Giuseppe, keep up the great work. I'm really honored to have had you on the podcast. I've been wanting to get you on for some time. So thanks so much for doing this, my friend.
Thank you so much, David.
Okay, so this was, I'm very proud of this episode. I feel like a couple that we've done recently, the one on Palermo and this one, if someone were to ask me what is Calcio Land all about, I would probably play these pods. So I want to wrap it up with two awesome things that I viewed this week and that reminded me of greatness, but in different ways. So on Saturday, I went to see Tool at the Garden here in Boston. I've been lucky enough. This was my fourth time seeing him in the past 10 years, third time at the Garden. Tickets were expensive. I was like, should I go? Should I not go? I've seen him many times. I've seen this tour before. I'm not sure. But then I was like, well, Tool are playing. They're close to my house. I should go. So I went. Absolutely blew me away. I've been a Tool fan since the mid-90s. And what I loved about this concert is how much they changed things up. I had seen the first leg of this tour. They changed a lot of the set list. They basically took out a lot of their staples, a lot of the songs that they're most famous for, 46 and 2, Schism, Stinkfist, Enema, none of that was played. They pretty much played almost all their entire new record, which is fantastic, and some of their other famous songs, and it absolutely blew me away. And it blew me away that a band that has such a strong catalog can constantly reinvent themselves and put on just an amazing show. The stage production was incredible. They're obviously incredible musicians. Got to see Danny Carey play guitar. Maynard was absolutely incredible on vocals. So huge credit for Tool still reinventing themselves, giving their fans something completely fresh and fantastic. On the completely opposite side of the spectrum, last night I got to see Godfather on IMAX. They re-released the first one for the 50-year anniversary. Again, I can't believe it's been 15 years. I haven't been alive for all of that, but for a lot of it. And, you know, Godfather is just a staple in my life, as it is for a lot of other people. I still remember exactly where I was the first time I saw The Godfather. I was at my grandmother's house in the south of France. He had a VHS tape of The Godfather. I had heard about it. It was late at night. I just popped it on. And I got to say, in some ways, my life really changed watching it. And of course, since then, I'd seen it like really a million times on TV. And I had never seen it in the movie theater. And I went to see it in the movie theater yesterday. And it was an absolutely incredible experience. Of course, I knew every line even before they uttered it. But it felt really, really incredible. And when you have such a powerful piece of work, I think some people have said it's the greatest pop culture work in any genre since it's been made. And I'd be hard to disagree with that. Like, this is a staple of greatness. So Tool reinvented themselves every time, was fantastic. Godfather didn't even need to do that. And that's how powerful it was. It also reminded me really of the magic of a movie theater. Again, nowhere near the same experience there. So if it's playing around you and you feel safe going, they're doing it for about a week for the 50th anniversary. Check it out. So I want to take this opportunity to thank everyone for listening to the pod. We do put a lot of effort into it. If you enjoy it, consider becoming a patron, tweeting about it, telling people, leaving us a review. We really do appreciate it. I want to dedicate this episode to anyone who suffers a big price just because of where they are born. Some people suffer a big price because of decisions that they make. Some people pay a huge price just because of where they happen to be born. My thoughts are with anyone who is in that situation. Look forward to chatting with you next week.